If you'd like to follow along, our scripture begins in the book of Genesis, chapter 1, verses that are very familiar. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. God saw that the light was good, and he separated the light from darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. And God said, "Let there be an expanse between the waters to separate water from water." So God made the expanse and separated the water under the expanse from the water above it, and it was so. God called the expanse sky. And there was evening, and there was morning, the second day. And God said, "Let the water under the sky be gathered to one place, and let dry ground appear." And it was so. God called the dry ground land, and the gathered waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let the land produce vegetation, seed-bearing plants and trees on the land that bear fruit with seed in it, according to their various kinds." And it was so. The land produced vegetation, plants bearing seed according to their kinds, and trees bearing fruit with seed in it according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the third day. And God said, "Let there be lights in the expanse of the sky to separate the day from the night, and let them serve as signs to mark seasons and days and years. And let them be lights in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth." And it was so. God made two great lights, the greater light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night. He also made the stars. God set them in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth, to govern the day and the night, and to separate light from darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the fourth day. And God said, "Let the waters teem with living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the sky." So God created the great creatures of the sea, and every living and moving thing with which the water teems, according to their various kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed them and said, "Be fruitful and increase in number, and fill the water in the seas, and let the birds increase on the earth." And there was evening, and there was morning, the fifth day. And God said, "Let the land produce living creatures according to their kinds, livestock, creatures that move along the ground, and wild animals, each according to its kind." And it was so. God made the wild animals according to their kinds, the livestock according to their kinds, and all the creatures that move along the ground according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created human beings in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, and over every living creature that moves on the ground." Then God said, I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth, and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food. And to all the beasts of the earth and all the birds of the air and all the creatures that move on the ground, everything with the breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food. And it was so. God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. Thus, the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. By the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing. So, on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. And God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. And then turning to the New Testament, the Gospel of John, the first verses of this Gospel, John chapter 1, beginning with verse 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of humanity. The light shines in the darkness, but the darkness has not understood it. May the Lord add a special blessing to this reading of his holy word. Those of you who know me know that I grew up on the coast and that I had the blessing of going to a state park, a beach, when I was a little boy. And so I had the opportunity to learn about building sandcastles from an early age. Perhaps some of you have had that opportunity. People approach the building of sandcastles in many different ways. There are those that are kind of casual about it, that might buy a bucket or two at the store and take a little plastic shovel that might buckle and perhaps even break when you're trying to use it in the sand. And then there are others who get a little more serious about it and invest in more buckets, perhaps a better shovel. And then there are those who want to be more artistic about it and argue that you're not going to use buckets. You're not going to use shovels. You're going to use your hands. And you're going to perfect the drip method. If you've ever taken wet sand in your hand and just watched it drip into that random pattern. And we think about how much time we might invest in building those sandcastles there at the ocean. But if you're little, you're not too aware of the waves that are coming in. And you've spent all this time building this sandcastle when those waves start eroding the foundation. And if you're a little kid, you might even start crying about it and realizing how fragile your creation was. But I think about that, and I think about the way so many of us approach life. There are those of us who like to be artistic, and artistic can express itself in many ways. It can be in the more formal definition of that term in terms of drawing and painting and sculpting, putting stained glass together. Or it might include things like carpentry. We think about the intricate patterns that can be carved into wood and the beautiful imagery that can be in chairs and tables and cabinetry. We think about all the different parts in life where a job can become an art. I think we see that in so many different professions, even if it's something like teaching, or a lawyer defending someone in the courtroom, or a doctor in the emergency room, we can all start saying, well, an expert moves from that's not a job anymore to that's an art. There's something creative about that person's work or expertise. And I think about this on a number of levels. I've taught some classes that have had an element of creative writing to them. And we speak about world building, about creating a world in which these characters interact with one another. One of my favorite writers spoke about being co-creators with God because he was a Christian. And yet at the same time, he was a writer creating these worlds that other people would pick up and read and study. And so that image of creativity being associated with our relationship with God. And then there are those who have over the years used the word inspiration and spoken about how God's Spirit can rest on us and can move through us to move us from a job to an art, to that creative spark, to doing something beneficial, something that adds to the world around us. And I think all these things help us to remember that to have the image and likeness of God ties us to creativity. And yet at the same time, as we read these passages and as we think about our own efforts, they're very akin to the child on the beachfront watching those waves come in. So often our efforts are fragile and have no lasting impact. And certainly in a fallen world in which we live, one marred by our frailties and our sins, we often see our creations fall, particularly if they are not in tune with the Creator. And so we come to these passages in the Bible, passages that we know very well. And we ask ourselves, how are we to understand them? We mentioned this last week, the passage in Job. Job is crying out to God, asking him, why did all these bad things happen to me? And we get to the end of the book of Job, and it's that impressive moment when God appears. And how does God appear to Job? In a whirlwind. Okay? Have you ever seen a tornado or been in the middle of a hurricane or seen strong winds? In the middle of a whirlwind, a voice asking Job, where were you at the beginning of everything? And I think that is the question we should always have in our minds when we approach this topic, when we approach this theme, when we read these passages. We are struck by how small and insignificant we are and how we are moving out into an expanse, into a depth that is just beyond us. And so here we pick up Genesis. And in that spirit of awe, in that spirit of humility, we read about the creation. Now, of course, there are many different ways you could look at these passages, to study them and compare them to other writings from the time or other cultures. That's not my focus here. My focus is looking at what we have in Genesis. And if you do go to the Hebrew, as Lori's referenced, you'll discover that this is a poem. And I think that strongly sets the context for how we're to read it. This is like a hymn that we're to sing, offering up an expression of our faith that the God of the universe created this world and created everything according to its own kind and created us with a purpose. Obviously, the structure here repeats, and if you read it through, you can start to get a glimmer of what the Hebrew poetry is like. Certain English translations of it do have the repetition of words to parallel the repetition in the Hebrew. And we get this structure. 6 days of creation. And the basic structure of the language follows this pattern. God says something, and then it happens. The power of God's Word brings things into existence. It doesn't try to explain how that happens. That is God's business. God speaks, and it comes into existence. That creative power, creator of heaven and earth. And then God pronounces what has been created is good. And I think that's another thing that's not accidental, something that is essential to understanding these verses. And then you get the refrain, there was evening, there was morning, and this was the first day, second day, on to the sixth day. And so we have the creation of the light. We know the separation of light from the darkness. We have the creation of the sky, the separation of the land from the water, and the creation of vegetation on the land. We have the creation of the sun and the moon and the stars and the seasons that govern our lives. We have the creation of the animals on the land and in the sky. In the sea and in the sky. And then on the sixth day, the creation of the animals on the land. And the final thing, we human beings see this as a stage, as a progression. We like to see ourselves as the pinnacle of the creation. But something that sets us apart, we have the image and likeness of God. And we'll be talking about this later in this series. But here, God sharing with us from the very beginning. We're not given a backstory on who God is or what God has presumably been doing before this point. We don't get that in Genesis. Instead, we get the story of the creation of the world in which we live. And we learn who God is as we follow this story along. And from this, we learn that God is powerful. That God is creative, has the capacity to bring things into existence. And that God is compassionate and loving and shares with that creation. We, of course, see the repetition of those and the exaggeration of those themes in chapter 2 when God is so concerned about Adam being lonely and the creation of the animals and then Eve and the partnership that comes out of those relationships. But through this, we see things that are beyond us. Things that we can only grasp toward and then acknowledge that we are so far beyond understanding these passages. So how do we today, gathered here, read and understand and appreciate and apply these passages about creation? About seeing God as creator of heaven and earth, as the Apostles' Creed and the Nicene Creed state. First, we need to acknowledge the cultural situation in which we read this passage. Obviously, we're on the other side of Charles Darwin. And Charles Darwin publishing a number of these ideas and in 1859, and the theory of evolution and how that has gotten out. But then we look back at the history of the United States. And there was a crucial court case in 1925 that has given a legacy that is still with us in a number of ways. Tennessee, at that time, had passed this law saying that schools could not teach evolution. A teacher in Tennessee started teaching this. And so the school fired him, and then a court case grew out of this incident. It drew national attention, and the figures of William Jennings Bryan, who was the fundamentalist Christian voice of the time, actively involved in politics, he decided that he was going to defend Tennessee's law against evolution. And then on the other side, we had Clarence Darrow, who represented science and political liberalism, and said that this law was unconstitutional and that he was there to defend the teacher. So there was a lot of grandstanding, there was a lot of running to newspapers, and typically, as we see today, there were a number who set easy targets on both sides, on Bryant, on Darrow, and lampooned them in them. Perhaps if you know the play or the movie that came from it, Inherit the Wind, you may know this story. But there is a crucial point in the exchange between Bryant and Darrow over how we're to understand creation. And Bryan, of course, says, go to the Bible and go to the Genesis to understand creation. Darrow, in typical lawyer fashion, was pushing and pushing and pushing Darrow. And there are all sorts of intricacies to this argument we don't have time to get into. But there came a point when Bryan said, well, maybe a day wasn't 24 hours. And that was sort of a turning point so that Darrow could jump on him and then move on to say, science opens up doors and questions that your worldview is holding back. And Bryan, of course, was saying, science is good to a point, but science doesn't give us a moral outlook on life. And so there's this back and forth, back and forth. Long story short, the court case, the decision came down. The teacher was guilty. He had to pay a fine. But then a few months later, these kinds of laws were later declared unconstitutional. And we know the kind of world in which we live now, that evolution has become a part of our curriculum. The court case gave us this image that it's an either-or situation. And I think that kind of binary understanding is not helpful. Science goes into a certain direction and asks certain questions. And good scientists acknowledge that evolution is a theory, that it's not a full-blown justifiable course of action or thought that can be opposed to systems of faith like the Christian understanding of creation ex nihilo, out of nothing. So we live in this world. And fundamentally, this passage should not be understood as a scientific document. It's not a science textbook. It is a poem. And there are truths that are in this poem that we Christians affirm in our faith that science cannot prove or disprove. We're talking about something entirely different. And to draw attention to this, we need to see that there is a strong difference between saying that the universe just happened to come into existence in the way that we live. And perhaps you've heard some of the metaphors that have been out there. Mathematicians in the 20th century and today have spoken about monkeys at a typewriter, randomly hitting keys. and saying that if you consider things completely random, eventually you'll get one of those monkeys randomly hitting keys producing Shakespeare's Hamlet. Okay. Saying that that would be a possibility if things are completely random. But then we look at that and we doubt that and we wonder about that. And then there are those who pull that metaphor out and saying, well, you've got a group of 12 monkeys and you've got a library. If you're talking about randomness, eventually those monkeys will produce that library, and on and on and on. There's a radical difference between speaking about something that just happens and something that is the product of a divine, benevolent will. Of course, you've heard in modern science tossing around the term intelligent design. And intelligent design gets us certain steps in this direction. But we understand here, and going back to that crucial word that we highlighted, that God says something and brings it into existence, and then God pronounces it good. So to know that God made the world in which we live, and that God made us according to our own kinds, and God celebrated all of those kinds and pronounced them good. And then on the last day, seeing everything in harmony, very good. So creation itself is something that God has affirmed. And so those philosophies and theologies over the years who have said the material world is a bad thing and that the goal of life is to escape it and get into a spiritual realm, that misunderstands this passage. Creation is a good thing. So when you celebrate a flower, when you celebrate the whiskers on a kitten, those are good things. And this passage affirms that. Genesis, though, also has chapter 3 that we know. And Adam and Eve listening to the serpent and sinning and turning against God. So we live in a fallen world. A world where things can be distorted. Where we can allow violence to reign. But fundamentally, creation is a good thing. And that all those statements about redemption that are coming in the words of the prophets, in the ministry of John the Baptist, and then crucially in the ministry of Jesus, who was the Word, who was there in the beginning. Nothing came into existence without the Word being there. The Word, Jesus, is attentive to the beauty in creation. And salvation is not just salvation for human beings. If you read in Psalms and in the prophets and in the Gospels and in Revelation, the redemption is for the world and for all of creation. And in the final chapters of Revelation, we have a new heaven and a new earth. Because our God is creator of heaven and earth. We come now to our time of invitation and commitment, a time for you to consider what God has done in your life. We Christians believe there is a moment of decision. And if you've never made a decision to be a disciple of Christ, a child of God, this moment is for you, so that we can pray for you and encourage you on that journey. Now also is a time for each one of us who've already made that commitment to ask ourselves again, are we living as in complete understanding and in complete appreciation of the fact that our world was created by a loving God? As we stand together and sing.